Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast with me, Robin, and Martin.
Hello.
Hello. How are you, Martin?
I'm well. I'm well. The British, we talk about the weather, don't we? But the weather's been scorching for about the last 2 months, and now there's a little bit of freshness in the air. There's a bit of rain.
A hint of rain. Oh, a dabble of rain. I'm glad. I'm looking forward to the rain. It hasn't arrived here yet, but I'm so grateful. I think I'll do a Shawshank Redemption when it comes, you know.
Oh,
run
nice.
Outside, open shirt.
Yeah. I like it.
Hands
I
in
like
the air.
It.
Wash off people, all the crap.
I wonder how many people get the reference just looking out the windows. What's that guy? Oh, Shawshank. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing.
Cool. It was amazing. Yeah. Did he change into that prison outfit before he got out there? And why has he smeared himself with sewage? What's going on there? Yeah. That's dedication, man. It's dedication.
Yeah. Yeah.
Today we shall be talking about the Boston Strangler.
Ooh.
And this is obviously a fairly dark topic. And thank you, Martin, for indulging me, because I was inspired to talk about this by the film that recently appeared on Hulu, if you're an American, or Disney Plus, if you're anyone else. With Keira Knightley and Carrie Coon in a film about the journalists who uncovered, so to speak, the Boston Strangler case of the 1960s. The film was very interesting, very good, but it also had some things I thought, is that true? And then that's what I wanted to discuss tonight. The case of the Boston Strangler, and does this new film really live up to the truth? The historical truth. But before we get to that, we'll talk about comments. We'll respond to your comments from the last couple of weeks. And before we get to that, I believe, Martin, you have a riddle for us, don't you?
I do have a riddle. Ooh. So riddle me this. Okay. I have cities, but no houses, forests, but no trees, and rivers, but no water. What am I?
You have cities, but no houses.
Mm-hmm.
Rivers, but no water?
Forests, but no trees. Okay, have a think.
Tough. Yeah.
And if you're at home and you're hearing this, drop your answer in the comment section.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think.
The only thing that comes to mind is football teams.
Yes.
Man City, not Forest. And actually, no, the Rivers doesn't work.
River. Mm.
Yeah. That doesn't work so much.
No, not really.
Man, yeah, what is it? I'm intrigued. Okay, yeah, looking forward to the answer for that one. And,
okay.
Everyone at home, feel free to let us know in the comments what the answer is. Those of you listening to us on a podcast platform of your choice will be aware, because we say it pretty much every week, that this podcast goes live on YouTube. So please do feel free to check it out over on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, and you'll get notifications for when we do go live. But if you are listening to us on a podcast platform of your choice, please do feel free to contact us at JinterestingYT on Twitter, or I'm at AllTimeRobin.
And I'm at Mart Interesting.
Oh, thank you. And before we move any further, actually, before I forget, I should definitely thank our wonderful Patreon supporters and YouTube members, who are genuinely some of the most wonderful people in the world. Obviously, all of our listeners are wonderful, genuinely. I mean, you've taken the time to listen to us. That's absolutely incredible. But these people go above and beyond. And I particularly want to thank James, Still Not Bitten, Safu One, Rashad Najjar, Caleb Wilkerson, Kurt Jones, John Baker, Janie, Henny Ruffle, The Super Show Podcast, Alex and Jamie, and Chris. Go check them out. Great podcast. Nicholas Dill, Emmett Tapia, Ahmad, Peaswad, Josh Tromatek, A Filthy Casual, Simon Workman, and Captain Wonky. So
thank you all so much.
But those are just the named ones. There are a whole bunch more of you who support us on Patreon and YouTube, and you are wonderful people. Thank you so much for keeping us going and for enabling us to do interesting things like going to York to film a couple of documentaries, one of which is already live on the YouTube channel. The other one will be published in the near future. And for doing our odd kind of video essay things, like you did a great one about the Pope killing cats or something, Martin, that was a while ago.
Yes. The Pope killing cats. And more recently, Robin, you went and looked into the origins of Bram Stoker's Dracula, didn't you?
I did, yes. I was in Whitby and made a video about it. Hopefully an interesting one. And I do love the novel Dracula. So any excuse to talk about it, I will take. Speaking of talking, what do our listeners say, Martin? Any comments that you want to respond to?
Yes. Well, I wanted to have a look. Well, I was intrigued, actually, looking through the comments about how many people knew about the Max Headroom incident. So we spoke about this a few weeks ago now. And I think it was in replying to another comment. Mm. I said on last week's episode, like, oh, it's interesting that Max Headroom, of course, you know, it's a British TV show. The character's from a British TV show. It was being aired during Doctor Who, which is another British TV show. Of course, it happened in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite interesting. Interrupted like a TV show in Chicago. And there was a whole load of people that replied saying, oh, no, I'm from America and I knew about Max Headroom. So Camera Shy Coco, absolutely familiar with Max Headroom. Same with Alan Half 2489. Max Headroom was broadcast regularly on American TV, first on Cinemax and then on ABC. And various other people said the same thing, which is pretty interesting. And so Camera Shy Coco made a good point. She said, perhaps it's an age thing. And perhaps it is. Perhaps it is, because I didn't know about it from the UK. So Max Headroom, my first exposure to Max Headroom was from the incident, not from the show itself. So it's interesting to know that actually it was pretty pretty popular in the US, maybe even more so than the UK.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to know, actually, because I was a bit worried when we were talking about that because it was a UK thing, that our American and Canadian listeners just wouldn't know what we were talking about. But they did, which is good.
It's always a concern. Sometimes, especially when we're talking about politics as well, it's like, will this just be completely out of touch to anyone that's not from the UK? So we reserve that for a little more interesting.
We do. A little more interesting, which is our Patreon and YouTube member exclusive kind of extra podcast episodes, I guess, that go up for them to watch at their leisure. And we do often talk about politics, although we try to avoid it because it's a bit grim. I was going to say at the moment, but...
just for the last 7 years, at least.
Yeah. Forever. just terrible.
Forever and ever.
Oh, amen. Man. Oh, dear. Well, there was a comment on our last episode, which was parents versus non-parents. Strange facts about what happens to your body when you become a parent. Including some incredible things and that almost make me want to become a parent.
Oh, almost. But not quite.
The whole stress and sleep deprivation thing still doesn't appeal.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see what happens. But from LW7340, we responded to a comment that they made on a previous podcast. Saying, and they suggested that we do a podcast episode about military blunders. We said in our last episode about parents, we said, yeah, that's a great idea. And then I went to our list. We got a list of ideas that we would like to talk about on the podcast. And I went to add this to the list.
It's such a great idea. We'd already thought of it.
We'd already thought. This is the geniuses that we are, folks.
I know.
This is why I'm bringing this up. I just want to, you know, let you know that we really are ahead of you in every way. we really aren't, by the way, for the record. We really aren't.
Yeah, I have to clarify that.
It probably says more. I hope it says more about the fact that some of our listeners, at least LW7340, is a like-minded individual who thinks, yeah, let's do this. Also want to say thanks to another commenter on last week's episode about parents, who, I'm sorry, I can't find a comment to read out your name, but you suggested a book that we could read to get ideas for military blunders. So thank you for that. You know who you are. Please do feel free to comment on this episode to remind us who you are. Sometimes the comments get lost in the mix.
Another comment that I'd like to bring up was from Taco Cat 3523. And they responded to the community post linking to A Little More Interesting on Patreon. And saying this was a great little episode and would be great if you could do another one. And this was related to the Am I the Asshole episode. And that was when you and Alex, I believe, I haven't watched it actually, but I believe you and Alex responded to Am I the Asshole posts on Reddit and were deciding whether they were the asshole or not.
That was exactly it,
which sounds like a great concept. And I'd be well up for doing one of those with you at some point, Robin. So
great, because
we record this one,
we can
do a part two.
Yeah, so let's do a follow-up,
So if you're not on Patreon, don't support us on Patreon, then you can listen to the Am I the Asshole episode by heading over to Patreon and supporting us for whatever you like.
Oh, excellent. And thank you for that, Taco Cat, for that comment. It's good to know. Great feedback. I've got another comment I'd like to draw attention to before we move on to the main discussion, which is from Microtech 5871, who says, last episode... last episode about parents living longer or whatever it is, we were talking, and in the background, Martin, there were noises, and they were kind of a rattling noise. And we know what it really was, but Microtech 587 suggests the rattling sound is Alex inside a burlap sack, like the movie Audition. Martin has him trapped.
I've got him. He's okay for now. Yep.
It's Alex trying to get out of a big sack. Although, have you seen Audition?
No, never seen it.
That was a, I think, fairly notorious film that came out around the year 2000, I want to say. Japanese film about a very attractive young woman who uses online dating to lure a guy back to her flat. And it turns out he's not the first man she's lured back to her flat. It's pretty sinister, pretty gruesome. And I recommend only hardcore fans of gory Japanese horror watch it. I can't really recommend it to anyone else. It was good, but you know, from on an objective level rather than an actual kind of, I'm enjoying this. Wasn't that kind of film at all. Yes. Speaking of films, I mentioned the Boston Strangler film. That's new out this year on Disney Plus. If you've got Disney Plus or Hulu, if you're in America, it may be available on other streaming platforms. I don't know. If you're interested in good dramas about journalists or about serial killers, you know, whatever floats your boat, this is a good kind of cross-section between the two. It combines the two. So let's talk about it, shall we? Let's talk about the Boston Strangler.
Yes, let's. So let's talk about the Boston Strangler. So a little bit of background for you, Robin.
Yeah.
Between June 14th, 1962 and January the 4th, 1964, 13 single women between the ages of 19 and 85 were murdered in the Boston area in Massachusetts. Most of them were sexually assaulted and strangled in their apartments, with items of clothing like stockings being tied around their necks. With no sign of forced entry into their homes, the women were assumed to have let in the murderer themselves, either because they knew him or because they believed him to be a maintenance man, a delivery man, or another serviceman. In fact, a lot of them, it was thought, let this man in, believing that he was there to shoot them as a photographer with them modeling. So this is how he came to get the name as the measuring man. I'll come take your measurements. I'll take your photos.
Right.
Quick Donna Leotard was what some of the, in the early stages that when they reported this man for sexual assault before the supposed, you know, before the murders happened.
Right.
This was like the MO, right? Came in, pretend to be a photographer, the measuring man, etc.
Right, and he'd say, get changed whilst so I can photograph you in this outfit, and then he would assault them.
Exactly. And also as a detective. So on October 27th, 1964, a man entered a young woman's home posing as a detective. He tied the victim to the bed, sexually assaulted her, and then suddenly left saying, "I'm sorry," as he went. This woman described the attacker, and this led people to identify him as Albert DeSalvo, a known serial sexual offender who had a crazy sexual appetite, was known for it, was previously in the army, I believe. And it was said actually that he'd, within his stationing out there over a course of a couple of years, had sex with more than 2,000 women. So he was hungry for sex constantly, which may have led to this kind of, you know, this sexual offending.
Wow.
So he was under arrest in Bridgewater Psychiatric Hospital for rape, and he befriended another inmate at the time, a guy called George Nassar, who was schizophrenic. And had murdered a man at a gas station. And Nassar told his lawyer, a guy called F. Lee Bailey, who actually later defended O.J. Simpson, that DeSalvo had confessed to him all of the Boston Strangler, all the murders attributed to the Boston Strangler. And then as a result, Bailey acted as DeSalvo's lawyer to handle these confessions. and to the police on the condition that it wouldn't be admissible as evidence in court.
What's the value of a confession that's not admissible as evidence? What's the point of that?
No, exactly. Exactly. Apart from, I don't know, some potential closure for the victim's families.
I suppose you can make that argument.
He's probably going to be locked away either for another murder or put in the psychiatric ward for the rest of his life.
I guess, he's already in jail, so the confession, gives closure. Now, I still think that's a thin argument. If I were a judge, I don't know if I'd accept that.
No. It seems a little bit like having your cake and eating it, doesn't it? Having a look, there was no real physical evidence that the crime's connected to Salvo. And I think it's something that comes up in the film as well, is that physical evidence wasn't there. It was just the confession of him. And there were plenty of inconsistencies, inaccuracies. And so the prosecutors couldn't bring a strong enough case against him. So instead, he was actually convicted for the rapes as opposed to murders and spent life in prison regardless. But the Boston Strangler killings remained unsolved as a result of this. So,
right, because if you go online, the first thing you'll see if you type in Boston Strangler is Albert DeSalvo. He's the Boston Strangler because he confessed, but actually they're officially unsolved. That's weird. But the film, actually, everything you've described is pretty much in the film, but the film takes a slightly different approach in that it follows two journalists, female journalists, played by Keira Knightley, who plays Loretta McLaughlin, and Jean Harris, who's played by Carrie Coon. And they're important because at the time, women just weren't investigative reporters. They just weren't allowed. The film kind of really makes that point quite strongly and effectively and in a good way. It's not beating you over the head with it, about the fact that these two women are trailblazers, essentially. And they worked for the Boston Record American newspaper, and Loretta and Jean caused a sensation for the articles that they published because they were the first people to publicly connect several of the murders. Up to that point, the murders weren't connected, and they were the first ones to say, actually, there's enough similarities between these murders that it's a serial killer.
Interesting. And I mean, like, serial killer as a term, it must have been pretty new around then, right?
I mean, yeah, I think you're right, actually. Yeah.
I think it was I think it might be, I mean, these killings, what was the date? I mean, we're talking like probably only 10 years by the looks of things. Approximately 10 years before the term serial killer officially
comes into usage.
Was used, serial homicide.
Yeah, multiple murderer, I think, was the common phrase before that point. But that could equally, in fact, I think it does still, like mass murderer applies to someone who can get a gun and just spray it into a crowd. And that's also a multiple murderer. But a serial killer evokes that particular brand of psychopath who preys on their victims and does horrible things. So these murders happened between summer 1962 and winter 1964. And these two journalists, Loretta and Jean, caused a bit of a sensation because they investigated so well. They revealed details of the crimes that the police didn't actually want in the newspapers. And the police tried to suppress a lot of their reports because they were sharing a little too much information. These two women also coined the name Boston Strangler. So we have the name of the serial killer because of them. And it must be said that the Boston Record American newspaper shamelessly used the fact that they were women to sell the newspapers. And they were the first time the reporters' photos were published as part of the reports because they wanted to be like, oh, look at these attractive women who are investigating.
Who kills women.
These crusading brave females, which they were, but I don't think the paper was being particularly noble in its celebration. But as well as reporting on the killings, they in the same reports they criticized the police investigation and made a lot of accusations about how the police investigation was being mismanaged. Eventually, after 29 articles on the Boston Strangler, they were taken off the reporting of the Boston Strangler murders because of political pressure from both within and without the newspaper. So they're
I see.
bosses weren't happy about these two women causing trouble, and the police, well, politics in Boston wasn't happy with these two women causing trouble and criticizing the police. Now, in the film, and this is where it gets interesting, in the film, it shows Loretta McLaughlin, which is Keira Knightley's character, refusing to let go of the case, even after she's taken off it. And she investigates further, despite not being allowed to, and she realizes that Albert DeSalvo's confession, which you've described already, was a bit dodgy, and she picks up on the inconsistencies that he describes between the crimes he committed and the crime scene details that the police had. And she realizes that he couldn't have killed all the victims. He may have killed some of them, but he can't kill all of them. So she realizes that there were multiple killers, not one killer. And maybe Albert DeSalvo was actually a patsy, perhaps for George Nassar, who's the prisoner that he met and confessed to.
Yes.
This is what the film shows. And incidentally, the reason that George Nassar is a suspect is because, as the film shows accurately, a neighbor who'd been coming into contact with the potential killer of one of the victims was shown a police lineup with Albert DeSalvo and George Nassar in it. And she identified George Nassar, not Albert DeSalvo, as the man that she'd met just shortly before her neighbor was killed.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I always think with police lineups, if there's two people that look even relatively similar, it's very difficult. I think in real time, it's very difficult to identify someone, isn't it?
Yes.
Like at the time of something, unless they're really distinctive.
Yeah.
And if you look at the pictures of, you look at the picture of George Nassar, you know, he looks fairly similar.
To Albert DeSalvo.
Very similar to, and that's not too far off.
Yeah.
At a glance, like if they were to, you know, whoosh past your face.
Okay, so you think that maybe it could still be Albert DeSalvo based on that?
Well, potentially, potentially based on that alone.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That, I mean, there's a reasonable point. I mean, I don't know how. Actually, I'd like to know what the, because I don't know if the police lineup process is particularly scientific. They, you know, they've got the height chart behind them, and then they all just walk in. And it's like, is it really the best way to view people? I don't know. Never had the privilege, I guess, of
I guess it'd be kind of in a non-criminal setting, it'd be quite fun.
Yeah.
Like you see some person doing something, doesn't matter what, like playing football in the park. And then it's like, which one of these people was playing football in the park? It's like, good question.
Yeah, actually, good question. Wouldn't mind doing that.
And would you be able to then identify them?
You know what we should do? We should do a kind of immersive experience. You know, like secret cinema where you dress up and...
Oh, yeah.
Tangent now. But we should do that, Martin. We should set up a whole thing where you go into a location with actors and the actors do stuff. Like one of them pretends to, I don't know, puncture a tire or something. And then you get taken to a lineup and all the actors line up and you pick out the person and see how many people.
That does sound quite good.
I think that'd be fun.
Actually, we get
it. I think people enjoy that.
Because then there'll be, I'm sure there've been studies on that. Like,
that must have been.
You know, identifying people.
Yeah.
Of course, it's nothing like seeing someone commit a crime. Maybe you're focusing more on what their face looks like.
Yeah, but in this case, it's someone she walked past before a crime was committed.
Exactly.
Yeah, not necessarily. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a good point. So apparently, and the film shows Loretta McLaughlin investigating further, and as she investigates Albert DeSalvo's confessions, she notices that although he accurately describes some details that only the police knew about of the crime scenes, he also repeated mistakes from some of the newspaper reporting about the crime scenes. They had this weird mix of accurate details that were suppressed from the newspapers by police, but also inaccurate details that were misreported by the newspapers.
Oh.
So that's a bit dodgy.
Yes.
She also, listening to his confession, realizes that the person interviewing him for the confession, the taped confession, which is Assistant Attorney General Bottomley, I know,
good
great
name.
When listening to it, he shows DeSalvo pictures of the crime scenes. So DeSalvo says something and Bottomley is like, shows him a picture and says, is that what you're talking about?
It's
like, obviously that's going to, that's not admissible. Like, come on.
No. No, you can't do that.
Just out of interest, in real life, Bottomley, who was in charge of the case, also consulted a psychic to try to solve the case.
So, man, this happens way too often.
Why is this a thing?
They do it, don't they? Like, it does happen in like police investigations of the past.
Yeah.
But there's like, yeah, there has been various cases where police have gone to psychics.
Yeah. It's like Jack the Ripper is a famous example, I think. And then, although rumored, and then, yeah, a bunch of others. So I did look into in more detail some of the things the film tells us and how true they are. And broadly speaking, the film is accurate. But I thought I'd just list a few things that the film shows which actually aren't true. And I think I'd like to ask your opinion after I've told you what the items are. Because I think it's problematic when films are inaccurate, but I think it's particularly problematic when films like The Boston Strangler are mostly accurate and then do some things.
They create some license on certain bits. Yeah.
Because then you blend truth and fiction and it gets difficult.
I know. It's much better if it's all just crazy. Like Inglourious Bastards is, you know,
that's a great
better
example. Yeah.
That'd be better than having another war film that's slightly inaccurate. In fact, have you seen that? I mean, this is a good series. Again, tangential here, but Penguin Books YouTube channel. Shout out to Penguin Books.
Oh, yeah.
I've done a couple of videos where they get a war historian on and he rates for accuracy and for, you know, how good it is, but for accuracy mainly, how true to real life certain scenes are in war films, and it's pretty good. Oh. It's pretty good, and
I love that kind of video. I didn't know Penguin were doing it. Yeah,
it's Penguin on YouTube.
Oh, I'm gonna watch that.
And of course,
I watched the Wired ones and the other ones. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. And History Here is another channel. Yeah.
What's there's some ones that you're like, oh, okay, that's surprisingly accurate, like Hacksaw Ridge. But it's not all. Yeah. It's not all like the story necessarily, but it's in like how things would happen. Like,
how
the clothes,
literally how
the
things are portrayed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that kind of
like
thing.
Actually those soldiers, most of them are wearing this type of coat, whereas some of them are wearing something else. And that kind of thing is great.
Yeah.
But yes, no, back to the matter in hand. Yeah. No, agreed. If something's slightly off, it's much worse.
How would this guy respond to the Boston Strangler? And I can tell you some things he might pick up on, which are, I mean, the first thing, and it's understandable, but the first thing is that, as we've said, the killings took place from June 1962 to January 1964. But the way the film presents it, it feels like it takes place between 1962 and 1965, and actually feels like it takes place in a much shorter time frame until towards the end, the date 1965 comes up on screen. And then you're like, oh, it's been 3 years. So it doesn't do the passage of time particularly well. But then it's even more problematic because something which we haven't discussed yet, but I'm sure you'll tell us to wrap up the whole story after I've described this. A key event that kind of ties up this whole story happened in 1973, and the film doesn't make clear that it's happening in 1973. The film makes you feel like it's happening in 1965, like it's all happened over a period of days rather than years.
Got it.
But what that particular event is, you'll describe in a moment. The other thing the film gets wrong, or misrepresents, I should say, is that it makes it, the journalists uncover the similarities between the killings and identify them as one killer's work by noticing one key detail in particular, which is that the Boston Strangler uses stockings to strangle the victims. Mm-hmm. And the film shows you photos of the crime scenes and has the police describe it and has the journalists describe it as always using stockings. It's the same killer. But actually, in real life, the Strangler used stockings a couple of times, but also used bras, scarves, a pillowcase in one instance.
What's there? Yeah.
Yeah. And that was part of the thing the police had a problem with. There wasn't actually a consistent modus operandi between the killings. Yes, they were strangled and they were sexually assaulted beforehand. But apart from that, there's all kinds of differences between the crime scenes and the nature of the killings. And it seems like he just grabbed whatever was to hand to strangle them with. And I think in one case, he actually used his hands. So the film kind of misrepresents that. I'm listing these things in order of what I think is like they're getting worse as we go on. Because the next thing the film does, obviously, because Keira Knightley is the main character, and Loretta McLaughlin, who's a real person, by the way, was very celebrated Boston Strangler and her later journalism. She's the central character, and the film presents it as though she leads the police to Albert DeSalvo.
Right, yeah.
And that on at the very end, he agrees to tell her the truth over the phone. And she's rushing to see him before things happen that mean the case will never be solved. But that's not true. That's just simply not true. The police found Albert DeSalvo independently of her. It was the whole bit of the film where she's just Albert DeSalvo calls her up and says, "I want to talk to you." That didn't happen. It was actually a doctor, Roby, who's the psychiatrist for the prison in which Albert DeSalvo was in, who that Albert DeSalvo called and said, "I want to talk to you and I want to tell you the real truth." They present Loretta McLaughlin with having a belief and a kind of instinct, a hunch that she frankly just never had. It's just isn't the case.
That's quite a big, but that's the kind of the main character syndrome, isn't it? These films, you've got to base everything around that main character. You pull in elements from history and attribute it, because otherwise the film is disjointed and the narrative doesn't really work.
Yeah. So I
you have to introduce and care about other characters. Yeah.
So you're right in that respect, but I feel like there are ways around that. You know, you could, for example, there's a character played by Alessandro Nivola, who's a police detective, and he's not real. He's not a real person. What he is an amalgamation of several other police detectives.
Right.
And that's okay. I'm okay with that, because, you know, like you say, for streamlining a story, for making it easier to invest emotionally, characters into one, that's fine. But why couldn't he be the one who uncovers major parts of the mystery, like the police did in real life, rather than play by Keira Knightley? That's my question for that. But it gets worse. In my opinion, that the film commits is that in the film, the police believe they've got one killer and they've captured Albert DeSalvo for it. He's confessed and it's done and dusted. And in the film, twist is that after she's uncovered the dodgy things in his confession, which she didn't do in real life, Loretta McLaughlin realizes that there wasn't just one Boston Strangler, there were Boston Stranglers. But this is untrue on two major fronts. And the first thing is that the police's working hypothesis throughout the investigation was actually that there were more. And it wasn't until Albert DeSalvo confessed that they thought, oh, it was one guy. And as I mentioned, it was Loretta McLaughlin and Jean Harris, I want to say was her name. Yes, Jean Harris, who invented the name Boston Strangler and this concept of a serial killer. And that's fine. That was their conclusion based on the evidence that they had. But the whole myth of the Boston Strangler as a single murderer was created by them. And then Albert DeSalvo confessed. And the police were like, oh, well, you know, that solves that then. Even though in real life, unlike in the film, the police were thinking, we think there's more than one. Some of them might be copycats based on the newspaper reports that you keep making and giving crucial details.
Exactly.
Then actually, so much so does the film misrepresent the truth that Loretta McLaughlin, as late as 1992, in the Chicago Tribune, that Albert DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler. Whereas in the film, in seemingly 1965, she's there racing around trying to convince everyone that, no, there's multiple killers and you've got to reopen the case. And this is a miscarriage of justice and the real killer's still out there because there's more than one of them. But that's just simply not true. She never said that. She never believed that. And I feel like that's in an age where people are very skeptical of the police already, I feel like misrepresenting the true history of a major serial killer investigation like that is kind of irresponsible.
Yeah, no, it is, isn't it? For the sake of drama.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, especially as it's it's by the sounds of it, it's as a, you know, biopic historic, you know, it relies on historical accuracy. It's not based on a true story, right? It's recanting the true story.
Yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that is problematic. Yeah.
And in fact, this whole idea that Albert DeSalvo's confession may not have been all it seemed to be comes from Dr. Ames Roby, the guy he called to say, I want to tell you the truth. And Dr. Ames Roby wrote in 1968 in an article for the Boston Globe that he heard another prisoner coaching Albert DeSalvo to remember something. At the time, he didn't know what it was, but he said, I'm not sure this guy's confession is all kosher, because I'm pretty sure that other prisoner was training him to remember something.
Right.
Of course, we know from his confession that it was definitely a bit dodgy, and some of his details may have come from the newspapers.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that DeSanto then, if he wasn't the Boston Strangler, if there were multiple Boston Stranglers, or even if he had, you know, he didn't kill anyone, do you think it was just kind of the fantasy and the notoriety? You know, he's going to be in prison for life anyway for a whole load of rapes he's done. Hmm. Perhaps he just wanted that notoriety. But I would say that there's not too much of a stretch between breaking into people's houses and forcibly raping them and then also strangling them, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't think there's as much of a... Criminally, there's a distinction, but in reality, you think about that kind of... Obviously, that passion, that kind of... what's the word? The adrenaline and all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, one of those things led to the next.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like... I'm not a criminologist, of course, but I think you're right. I think it's very easy to see an escalation of that violent crime from assault to murder.
Seems like
Yeah. And there's something, not getting too dark, but like there's intimacy when you strangle someone. And I feel like that's
What? It sounds like you're speaking from experience.
No, that's not what I mean. I have no idea what it's like when you strangle someone. But you know, if when you're sexually assaulting someone, obviously it's an... Okay. I find it easy to imagine that sexual assault is an intimate act for the person doing the assault. I assume for the victim too, but I don't want to assume anything. And therefore strangulation, which is an intimate method of killing someone, seems like a logical extension of that too.
Right. Gotcha.
Just the fact that you killed them, is the method of killing seems like a logical extension of the sexual assault, to me at least.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And if, you know, the evidence that the sexual assaults did happen, even if there wasn't outright evidence, it seems logical, but we will never know. I mean, there wasn't any physical evidence that tied DeSanto to the murders themselves. So, you know, we're not going to know in that regard. Mm. And then, of course, November 1973, he was stabbed to death in the prison infirmary. So he had recanted his confession to Roby at this time, Roby was on his way to hear DeSalvo officially withdraw his confession when DeSalvo was murdered. And actually, it was never determined who killed DeSanto, which is utterly bizarre. That wouldn't come out and nobody was criminally charged for it. Just crazy in itself.
Well, on the day that the guy's going over to take his withdrawal of confession.
Yeah.
That was definitely...
I know.
That must have been the real Boston Strangler was there and killed him. Maybe arrested for something else. Arrested for another rape. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe. But so we will officially, we'll never know. And that must be horrendous for the families of the victims as well.
Yeah.
Right. Some of it's circumstantial, but evidence pointing to this person, and then for that to be taken away from you. Like, you know that this guy is obviously, they've got to be dead, but he was going to be put in prison for life regardless. Mm. But there's not justice for you individually. Like, you don't care if this guy's got 10 life sentences, if he was going to get another one attributed to your loved one, you'd want that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And
It's accountability.
Particularly, yeah. I think that's it. Also knowing the circumstances, because we know for a fact through Dr. Romy, the psychologist, that he said he wanted to withdraw his confession. So you've got to make a choice as a family member, I guess, as a relative of the victims, to say, I'm going to choose he was the killer and he was just withdrawing his confession to stir some crap up, rather than choose to believe that he actually wasn't the killer, in which case the killer's still out there and we'll never know. Anyway, is this worse than, say, Jack the Ripper, where we never caught him?
In some ways, yes.
Or is it...
I mean, I think if you believe that he was the Boston Strangler and he did kill these women, although he was never convicted, there's a high, in my opinion, there's a high likelihood, even if he didn't kill all of them, but kill, you know, it's by the seams of it, he killed at least some of these women. And so that, in that sense, you can make up your own mind and know, you know, who done it. But yeah, it's just, I think for the families, there's definitely an injustice. Whereas if no one's ever caught, there's an injustice, but it's not like this, you know, we know who it is, but they haven't been, the justice hasn't been served. It's just, we haven't found out who it is. So yeah. It's pretty horrible. Do you think in your heart of hearts that there were multiple killers in Boston at this time with similar but not identical MOs?
I think yeah. I think I don't know him enough, but I feel like I've seen enough true crime. I've read enough true crime novels and reports, and I've read enough, seen enough films and TV, I guess, to feel like killer changed their MO in as many ways as the Boston Strangler seemed to do. And the doubts around DeSalvo's confession stick with me. The fact that he got some details wrong and then mimicked details that were mistaken by the newspapers does seem dodgy. But at the same time, he knew stuff for sure about some of the killings that could only mean he was there or knew someone who was there. So, and it's hard. I don't blame the police for this, but it's hard not to think that by 1964, the police were just so desperate to close the case, anything would do. And as soon as someone confesses, and it's a plausible confession, it's like, well, yeah, like let's close the lid on this, you know? I don't know if that's fair of me to assume that of the police. I just feel like I don't blame them if that was how they felt. And we're like, okay, we've solved it. It's done.
I'm sure that's how a lot of police forces feel when you have the pressure of the media, especially on you to make an arrest, to attribute it to someone. And of course, 13 families as well, who I'm sure were not silent in their phoning up of the police. Mm. So I can understand it, whether it's the right thing to do or not, is another matter. But yeah.
It's tough.
So it would be interesting to know, do we know whether there was any of the DNA evidence? You know, we've spoken about it before, about going back to historical cases and being able to definitively solve many years on. It'd be interesting to know if there was any movement on that side of things.
DeSalvo's remains were exhumed in 2013. And DNA was compared to DNA from the crime scene uncovered in 2001. And there was a link. It was DeSalvo. So he definitely has been connected through DNA to the final victim. That's a good point. The question is, can we assume, therefore, that he killed the others? The previous 12?
Well, there we go. I mean, I imagine that, as technology... you know, improves as it has done up till now, we'll have more answers in the future, but we'll see.
That's pretty conclusive.
That's a big...
Yeah.
That's a pretty big tick in the box.
I'm reconsidering my answer to your previous question now about whether I think there were multiple murders or not. DNA. So, yeah, go. Thanks for discussing that there with me, go. Martin. I was really interested by it, by the film, which is a good film, by the way. It's a pretty good film. I rank it fairly highly on the list of journalists investigating serial killers. There aren't many of those, but it's a good one. Anyway.
There's a few.
Yeah, there's Zodiac. Zodiac, I think, is probably the king.
Zodiac's a really good one.
I like it, actually. I just like that genre of films of journalists investigating things. All the President's Men.
Yeah.
The best ever. The Post is pretty good.
The Post is pretty good.
Zodiac, of course. Boston Strangler. Oh, there's another one. There's another major one that I'm missing. But never mind. It's not what this podcast is about.
No. So what would you recommend it then? So you're thinking, what, 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10?
Yeah, leaning towards 7, I think. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well made, good story. And one thing I haven't mentioned is that it's very 2023 in the fact that it really leans into the theme of women's place in society and women's treatment by 20th century society. But of course, things haven't changed too much. And it's good drama and good kind of serial killer thriller as well. So it works on both.
Serial killer vibes.
Yeah. Cool. I wouldn't go in with like really high expectations because I think it's...
Sure.
It does some things that are a bit... If you're familiar with it, you clearly watched the films that we just listed and talked about. So if you've seen those films, then you'll watch Boston Strangler and you'll see a few similarities. If it might be like, I wonder where I got this idea from. Classic things. But I want to know, Martin, firstly, I want to know what our listeners think. Please do tell us, either in the comments below on YouTube or on Twitter at JInterestingYT. Who do you think was the Boston Strangler? Was it Albert DeSalvo or was it multiple people? Tell us, please. And also, Martin, I must know, what on earth is the answer to that riddle?
The riddle. So, yes, again, I have cities, but no houses, forests, but no trees, and rivers, but no water. What am I?
Cities, and forests, and rivers.
Yeah, any late guesses there?
Honestly, no. I'm really stumped.
Well, the answer is a map.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Cities.
That's a good one.
No houses. Yeah. Forests. No rivers.
That's very clever. Yeah.
Sorry, rivers, but no water. That was it, yeah.
Damn it. I'm annoyed. Oh, annoyed I didn't even think of that. I like maps.
I was terrible at map reading, though. I think we did it for one year at the age of 11. And when you're that age, you'll be like, what the hell's going on? You basically just come out of junior school, haven't you?
Yeah. I used to be fairly good at maps, but then since my smartphone was able to give me a map with my location on it, I look at a real map and I'm like, I have no idea where we are.
My phone, it does a weird thing where if I put it on like the walking mode, the directional arrow doesn't change. So I'll be facing the way that when I turn on the maps, I'm facing, say, north.
Yeah.
And then when I walk east or west, I'm still, according to maps, facing north, but the arrow is just moving. And it's just very confusing. Then when you get to a junction, you're like, so the arrow is pointing that way, but actually I'm not pointing that way. I'm pointing
this way. That's wrong.
And then you have to work out
that's just confusing.
Which way to go. It's confusing, but for a map reader, if you're actually good at maps, you'd be like, there's even a dot moving in the right direction. How do you not know where this is? I do feel like, the olden days with holding an A to Z up to the steering wheel, like that must have been a nightmare in big cities.
Oh, man, yeah.
But alas.
I used to have fun with that. I was the navigator. I had the map open on my lap in the passenger seat. And I'd be telling us where to go. And now I look at it, I have no idea. Especially since if you're driving on motorways now in the UK, this is probably very familiar to American audiences, but we finally got into 3 and 4 lane motorways being the standard thing. Whereas years ago when I used to navigate, they were still on 2 lanes. So you could see some countryside around you and be like, oh, there's a way marker. I can find that on the map. But now it's just 8 lanes of tarmac and I have no idea. Just can't see beyond the grey. Just can't see it.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. It's a dystopian future.
Yeah, it's the way we're going. We're just going to be, was it Mega City 1 from Judge Dredd? Britain's going to get there first because we're a small island just building constantly.
It's true, actually. Yeah,
probably too. Anyway, thank you for listening to us. Thank you for joining us. Hopefully, we'll be back next week with a full complement of three of us. And hey, we'll probably do a quiz, which will be great. And thank you so much for listening to us. Please do share your thoughts and comment below. And we'll see you the next time.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.